WBAI. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmid is brilliant and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. Tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
This program. All right, well, it's time to turn to Gene Shepherd. We try to bring you lost episodes, and due to very unfortunate circumstances, a whole lot of uncirculated episodes are coming our way from the estate of Gary Hines, a major Gene Shepherd radio collector. He's got hundreds more shows than I ever heard of. He used to outbid me on eBay all the time and go home with the prizes of all those old Shepherd reels. I suspect this might be from one of them. From August 12th, 1963, an early version of Shepherd's story as it appeared in Playboy, The Secret Mission of the Blue Ass, the Buzzard. So that's our lost Shepherd for today, thanks to the Gary Hines estate. Why don't we hear it? Lost Gene Shepherd to close out this episode of the Dustbin of History, WBAI New York.
experienced the new flavor treat, the new treat that all of us have been enjoying here in Studio Land, as the new experience. Oh, my God. It's starting already. It's only Monday. not here 30 seconds. I just want... Come on, bring it up there. Let me hear it now. I'm just wild about Harry. Oh, Harry's wild about me. My little old ladies are listening to us, nervous people. This is the family station, you know. And we've got John Gambling and Martha Dean here, and I've got to remember where I am. This is the same, very self-same studio that Lyle Vann broadcast from, and that's as square as you can get. And I've got to remember, I don't want to start tilting the boat here. Yes, I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild. I wish I knew the lyrics to that song. I have a suspicion that I could sing that. Try that once again, Don. I'm just... All right, bring it in. Come on, let's go now. All right. Just wild about Harry. Oh, and Harry's wild about me. I think I could sing that one very good. It's a terrible song. For that reason, I think I could sing it very good. You know, speaking of... terrible songs. It's Monday, and for those of you who are nervous people, and I think most of us are nervous people these days. I mean, you know, just in general, nervous. No. It's funny how, you know, you can't be really seriously nervous about the bomb anymore. You know, it's not the bomb. It's just kind of a passé nervousness. In fact, the causes are hard to find. I suppose the only cause that most of us really are nervous about is our own skin in the end, in one way or another. If we can somehow make it into a positive philosophy, we're in business. You know, if somehow you could prove to the world that your skin is more valuable than anybody else's and get kind of a religious crusade going for it, perhaps you're on your way. But why I brought this up, you know, it's Monday and it's August and... You know how it is. It's a kind of an in-between thing here. And I don't like to get people nervous, but the other day I took an airplane flight, the very quick one, and I see the guy driving the plane is a very official type. You know, have you noticed the airplane ads recently where they'll say, oh, yes, Commander Don Winslow, it'll show him getting out of his KLM plane or his American Airlines plane. He's square-jawed, and he's silver-haired. Have you noticed that almost all of them now are silver-haired and bronzed? And it says his hobby is mosaics. He makes mosaics in his spare time. He's had over 10 million hours in the air, and he's flown the equivalent of 37 times around the equator on one motor alone. And this man, you know, is obviously a father, obviously somebody you can trust completely all the way, you know. And you can, you know, you can put your whole life, everything, your portfolio, you can put your resume in his hands, and you know that it's going to be all right. You know that kind of thing? Have you noticed some of those ads? Well, I'd like to tell you, I don't want to embarrass any of you out here, but I don't know whether I should do this or not. Again, paralleling with this little trip I took, I noticed that the pilot was a big, fat, elderly, solid-looking man. And you know that anybody who drives an airplane like that, a big airplane of that kind with 9 motors and 8 stewardesses and a bar and all, well, he's not a pilot anymore. Well, I don't know what he is. He's really not a pilot. You know, you don't fly a 707, do you? Like you fly a Spad or a P-51. No, I mean, it's an operation. It's like a guy that's running the train. somehow. A great big long train, you know, with Pullmans. You never think of a guy sitting up there smoking a cigar and spitting out of the window and driving this thing madly 190 miles an hour, you know, hollering, whoopee, wow, you know, and he pulls the lever, but watch this, Charlie. He goes around the corner. You don't ever think of that. Well, I want to tell you a little thing. By way of a disclaimer, if you're a weak type person, and you know, the kids and women and stuff, and it's Monday, you can go down the dial there where they're playing some soft Mantovani music. And a little bit to the right of us here, I think they're getting well into a Haydn quartet. I think you'll like that. And a guy's getting prepared to interview an angry man who's about to write a bill to do away with boxing or something. Barry! He's down there. He's got a lot of very important things going on. You can get away from this, you know. I'm perfectly all right here. Well, I'm going to have to tell you about the time that I learned about flying, and the hard way, in a very interesting way, I'll tell you. I watched a movie here about a week or so ago. I don't know whether you saw it. It was a movie about World War II, about these guys in this airplane. And there are a lot of very, you know, there were a lot of World War II airplane-type guys that were in this plane. Jimmy Cagney, I think, was there. Jimmy Stewart was somewhere on the premises. You know, that crew, hard-limbed and square-jawed and all that stuff. Well, they didn't exactly paint it the way it was. I'm going to have to tell you how it was. For those of you who have grown up recently on a diet of World War II films, let me tell you what happened to old daddy here one time. Now, you see, I'm working for the government at this point. To be honest with you, as a corporal at this period, I went up and down the command scale like a yo-yo. One point in my career, I went all the way up to T4 there for a while. That's a sergeant, you know. And then I bounced down to PFC. I was there for a couple of weeks. And then I went up to corporal. Then I went down to private. Yes, I was a private there for a long while. And then I made it back up to PFC. Well, I've got an interesting record, but it was very, very funny. It was like a doctor's chart, you know, of some guy with a fantastic case of malaria, you know, going up and down. Well, yeah, I never knew exactly how much I was going to make any given month from one month to the next. You were truly in the lap of the gods. Now, I'll say that one of the things that you learn about, and this program tonight will be entitled Education on How It Is program, for those of you who are interested in educating how a guy learns how what he is, you know. Well, one thing about being a civilian and living in, particularly in 20th century 1963 America, is generally speaking, you are never truly in the lap of the gods. Now, you always are, actually, but you never know it. In America in 20th century, everything is produced, engineered. The whole world is a press agent world. You know that. There's no such thing as a normal news story. It just comes out. Immediately, as soon as a chick gets busted, like all these chicks, you know, in the Ward trial, they're immediately, oh, they've got more contracts now. They've got more agents. They've got PR men working for them, the whole bit. You don't know how much of it's truth anymore and how much of it is all part of a movie scenario that some guy's feeding them in the back room for a picture about to be turned out by Cheapy Productions, which will hit the 42nd Street very shortly, starring, what's her name, Keeler or Mandy Whoopi Grimmies or whatever her name is, that little skinny one, you know. Well, so you don't know. You don't know where life begins and existence starts, or whether it even, you know, where they meld in there together. Well, I, of course, was brought up prior to my experience in the Army Air Corps. I was brought up on a strict diet of Errol Flynn movies. And I had come through the Chester Morris School of pilot. You know, I'd seen all those movies about the pilots. Chester Morris, you could trust Chester Morris to the end of the earth, right, Don? Absolutely. Pat O'Brien, let me tell you, I remember pictures where Pat O'Brien was flying those airplanes, and he could fly better than the plane himself, personally, right? You never saw Pat O'Brien then. And if Pat O'Brien crashed, he would just get up and sort of hold his head a little bit and walk around and hold his arm. And you knew that Pat O'Brien was in charge of the situation. Never any problem like that. And I saw Clark Gable one time crash in an airplane. Yeah, I remember that time. Clark Gable, he was a test pilot or something. You remember that one? Or Navy pilot or something? And he crashed in that airplane. You never saw anything like it. That airplane went through the rocks and bounced off the mountains and crashed into the trees. And he got up and dragged himself out and started to fix it. And sure he did. And there was another guy with him. I think it was Spencer Tracy. And he and Spencer Tracy says, well, we've got to make it go. So sure enough, the last scene is that they're going along the beach, hopping over the rocks in this wrecked airplane. They took off, and naturally. And I believe Spencer Tracy himself flew it with his teeth. I think Clark Gable was tied on the back, and he flew all the way back. You know, and Spencer Tracy didn't know how to fly. You remember that one? He didn't even know how to fly. And Clark Gable is laying on the wing. He's strapped on, and he's telling him. He says, I'll put your foot down to the left now. The airplane and Spencer there, and he landed it on a carrier yet on top of it. Well, now, you know, when you come up through that route, you have a complete feeling of security when you're confronted. Because I also have read a lot of G-8 and his battle aces, and they never mentioned that G-8 couldn't fly his airplane. G-8 was very good. Speaking of the inept, this is WORAM at FM New York. You'd never believe it. WR doesn't know anything about radio. You know? Funny, it's a lot of outside. Oh, well, that's another problem. We'll go into that later. That's for the seminar. That's for you graduate students who might come in there later. Oh, that's true. You know, I'll tell you, those of you who think that's a funny remark, do you know that I have been here for over 1,700 years, and I have not yet seen one executive here in the studio? I don't. Do they know how to do radio programs now? They don't come around the studio. In fact, one day I was working at a television station, and I was having a terrible time getting something done production-wise, as we say on the Avenue. And I went into the vice president there in charge of everything, saying, I says, well, I'm having a terrible time. I says, why don't you come down and see what's going on down there? It's a madhouse, a fist fight. There's nothing but terrible, rotten stuff going on. He looked at me and said, Shepard, I prefer not to know. It's much easier to make decisions. Well, you know. So if if any of you are thinking of inviting a big-time radio executive to come to your school to tell you about radio, forget it. He could tell you a lot about lunches and, you know, sales execs, but I don't think he can tell you much about the business, but that's another story. So I was brought up all the way through that whole thing, you know, about airplane pilots. And even today, I'm sure that most of us now are being brought up through the big four-color ads and the full-page thing in Life, where it shows Captain Don Winslow with 8 million hours and so on. Well, let me tell you what happened to Daddy here. See, I'm this hard-fighting, hard-hitting corporal, T5 corporal. Well, I was a corporal there, full corporal then, command corporal. And I was in radar. Now, I was airborne radar at that point in my somewhat checkered career. And airborne radar is, a lot of things. That's not guys that jump out of the airplane. Now, every time you mention airborne, that people think you could jump out of airplanes. But an airborne radar guy, he puts radar in the airplanes, and a lot of times he rides around with it. And he tests it, and he does all kinds of things with the radar that is in the aircraft. Now, that's airborne radar. Well, I'm in the airborne radar scene. So one day, the CO... And up to that point, I've been doing a lot of flubbing around with the radar equipment and sending it out. You know, with about 500 other guys, and we're getting shocks, and we're making the stuff go, and then we're making it not go. And it's very interesting. It's a lot of games, you know, fun and games. It's like you're learning how to play with things. And we're fixing the stuff and sending it out. One day, the CO comes in. He says, Shepard, he says, you're going down to Drew Field. Well, I said, Drew Field, yes. He says, you're going down to Drew Field. He said, they want some special equipment put in this A-20. It's a Douglas A-20 down there. And you're going to go down, and you're going to go up and work with the equipment, test it, and so on. They'll give you instructions when you get there. Go. Well, they put me in this command car, and they took me to the airfield. Well, this was Drew Field. And it was a great big Air Force base, you know, the kind of bases that you see in the movies where Dick Foran is learning how to get his wings, and, you know, where Alan Ladd is the square-jawed captain, and he's got this thing going with Veronica Lake, and their plane crashes at night. You know the place. You know, you've seen it a million times in the movies. Well, I go down to Drew Field. And there I am. I'm very excited, you see, because all these airplanes are all around, thousands of airplanes, and up to this point it had been highly theoretical to me. You see, we had just been working on the equipment, and then they send it away, and somebody says, well, this is a P-38, this goes into the P-61s, and so on. And I knew about these things all theoretically. I could tell you where every bolt went to install the equipment in, say, a P-61. The Black Widow. I could tell you all, every bolt, every last connection for the radar equipment that went into the Douglas A-20, which was an attack ship. Well, this is the difference again, of course, between theoretical education and actual education. And so a guy would come down into the shop and he'd say, "Hey, Shepherd, we're on number 7, number M214, number 16, SCR, number 7, SCR, number 2, and I would reach down and I'd pull it out of the right. I'd say, "Of course, that's the modified B. That's the modified BA Series E, Douglas A20, right?" And he'd say, "Yeah, right." And I'd pull it out and I'd give the thing and then hand him the bolts and then the whole thing. I knew all about it. You see, the point is I knew everything it was about it. So one day they sent me down to this airfield. "You got it, kid? I'm at the airfield now, and I'm wearing my clean suntans because they shipped me down there on this 3-day tour of detached duty down to Drew Field, and I'm the expert now on this particular type of equipment that is going into the Douglas A-20 attack ships." Well, now, the Douglas A-20 is a very interesting airplane, very interesting. Has a very high tail, very pretty airplane. And, in fact, a model of it is still flying around. You see them all around here going up and down the coast. They call it the B-26 now. That same airplane that was bombing, that was involved in the Cuban invasion. You're interested? Yeah, the same thing. They just changed the name a little bit and jazzed it up. And it's the same airplane. Well, in those days, it was a very jazzy, very fast, very sneaky, and a highly erratic aircraft. But a very pretty airplane. And so I'm standing on the field. This thing is coming along the ready line. I look down. I says, "Oh, yeah, it's a Douglas A-20. Yes, I had gone through. I will award the brass piglegi with bronze oak leaf palm for any of you who could tell me what weft means. Come on, weft. What was the weft system? Come on." Huh? Not American people again. So I'm using my weft system, and I immediately says, "Douglas A-20. Comes down the ready line, and gee, it's a beautiful thing. You know, it's all camouflage. At the bottom is sort of painted the sky blue, and the top is that buff brown, and it's got all everything. It's got all the combat insignia. This baby was really going out for action. See, she comes from, and it's got everything. It's got the guns. It's got the racks. It's the whole business is there. Now, this is a three-place airplane. Three-place airplane, consisting of the pilot and a guy who is like the bombardier navigator. It's a low-level attack bomber and stuff, you see. And there's a guy in there called the radio operator. He's in the middle. Well, this thing comes down the line, and there's a mechanic driving it. He pulls it up, and he gets out, big, tough-looking mechanic. He, you know, the kind that they always had people like Mickey Rooney play, or William Bendix usually played that role. You know, Bendix? "Hey, ship is okay, Chief." He gets out, and he hits it, and he walks away. And I'm supposed to wait here for the crew to come over who are going to fly this airplane, and I am going to fly in this airplane with them, and we are going to work on this equipment together. It is a joint venture. Now, I'm waiting for either, well, I would have settled for Chester Morris. I'm waiting for either Chester Morris or Alan Ladd to show up. You know, I'm waiting there because I'm brought up through the whole thing, you know, the whole world. William Holden would have worked out pretty well, don't you think, Don? He would have worked out okay. So I'm standing on the ready line there waiting around, and they have given me all the equipment because I'm going up with these guys. And I've got a parachute hanging on the back, and I've got a parachute hanging on the front. And I've got this canvas suit on, this flying suit, you know, that zips up all the way to the top with a big fur collar on it. And I'm waiting down there, and they give me a big helmet with the big goggles and stuff with the earphones. And so I'm ready to test the equipment. Well, I go over to the airplane, and I climb up. I knew how to get into these things because I had installed some of this equipment before. So I climb up, you know, it says use no steps, step here. So I swing myself up. I get up there, and I slide the thing back, and I look, and there's the equipment all in there. Little canopy and everything is fine, and it's working out well. So I walk back over to the little office there next to the hangar, and there's a phone there. So I call the control board. Glass thing there. What do they call that place now? Yeah, the control tower, that's right. And I dial them, and they had a dial system. This is for control tower. So I call the control tower, and I say, "Well, I'm the guy that's working on this radar equipment on ship number such. And I'm down here, and I just want to make sure that that the intercom system's working well here and so on. Okay, so we tested a little bit and we're fine. See, everything works great. And I'm feeling really on top of it, you know. I'm really in charge of everything here. I've got all the equipment going. And I think, well, at last, Shepard is on his way. He's really working with the real stuff now. I climb down and I sort of loiter a little bit underneath the wing and I feel like a combination of, I'd say roughly a combination of, Ted Scott, you remember those great books about Ted Scott flying his monoplane? A little combination of Ted Scott, a little touch of Chester Morris. I had a little feeling of a little William Holden running around inside of me there, and I'm square jaw, and I'm sort of standing next to the plane. Well, remember, you got to remember that I am pushing roughly 18 at that period. I'm a very immature 18. You know, I filled out the suit all right, but there was a lot of farina up there between the ears. Maybe it was Ralston, I don't know, but it's in between the ears there. And I'm waiting for the guys to show up. When I see these two characters coming down the line, one of them is 11 years old and the other is 12 and a half, these two guys. Now, the 11-year-old guy had a lot of pimples. He had a lot of pimples, and he was eating a Milky Way bar. And as he ate the Milky Way bar, I could see that he was still, you know, he's still having trouble with his milk teeth there, you know, he's eating there. And this 11-and-a-half-year-old guy, and the other guy who was 12 and a half, still had pimples, but he had graduated from Milky Way bars to Powerhouse bars. He was eating a Powerhouse bar, and the two were hitting each other. Yeah, son of a gun. They're hitting each other. You know, they're 12-year-old kids. One hits the other guy. Come on, I'll fire. Come on. Oh, I bet you can't beat me. Wow, wait. And they start running. These two guys are running along, and they're racing each other to the airplane. Oh, they're letting the kids out here. What is this? An airfield. Come on. Well, these two guys come running up to me, and one of them says, hey, hold on. He hits me. Pow. And I tower over these two kids. You know, one's 11 and a half, the other's 12. So he hits me in the chest. He says, hey, you, come on. Well, let's see who. And we're running around, and it suddenly dawned on me, one is a captain, and the other's a first lieutenant. Well, the captain is going to drive the plane, and the first lieutenant is going to sit in the back. He's going to be the navigator bombardier, you see. I am the corporal, and we're all going to play airplane. Well, I got a little worried right away there, you know. I thought, well, you know, now they're going to bring William Holden out here now any minute. They're sending the kids. It's just a gag. And they had these crush hats on, you know, the kind of hats that roll down over the ears. You know, the crush hat. It's a gag. And I could see that the 12-and-a-half-year-old kid had probably shaved twice. You know, you could see where it was chafed around the chin, where the little pimples cause, you know, where the guys get those little blonde hairs and they shave them off and then little sort of gets ingrown. I could see that he was having trouble shaving. He hadn't learned how to shave yet. And I was going to, you know, give him the little word of advice there about, you know, using hot water and all that done, you know. Well, the other kid obviously was not shaving at all yet. It was a little bit too soon for that. He just had this little down around the edges. And they were both very pimply and very skinny. I think the first lieutenant must have weighed about 87 pounds. And the captain, who was a little bit taller, I'd say he pushed about 95, the two kids there. And their suit hung off, you know, all the way down. So the captain says, all right, Mac, come on, get in, let's go. We don't have time to fool around. What do you mean, Mac? You little son of a gun. You know, I wanted to hit him. You know, I said, come on. Well, I climb up in there, and he gets up in the back. That's right. He's in the back. And the other guy gets up in the front. And we're in this Douglas A-20 now. It's a big, very big airplane. And it's all of a sudden the wings are stretching out on all sides of me, and I can see the mechanics way down on the ground. And so they start. They start the port engine, you know, the starboard engine, and this thing is really a big airplane, and the propellers are going around, and I got my helmet on, and these two guys are on. I can hear their bubblegum popping in the intercom. Pow. Hey, Chucky, you back there? Yeah, hey, Chucky, whoa. Pow, they're popping the bubblegum. I'm sitting in the middle, and somebody says, hey, Mac, you with us? Yes. Well, you know, what do you say? I mean, it's very difficult when you're 18 years old and you feel very old compared to the pilot. It is very difficult. Because I thought I was a kid, you know. Up to that point, I'm just a kid. You know, I'm sending home for my mother's, you know, my mother's sending me, telling me what's happening on the Little Orphan Annie show while I'm missing it. I'm in the Army. And she's writing me, telling me what's happened to the TM Bar Ranch, you know, how Jimmy and Jane are doing. And, you know, I'm keeping up with the news. And here are these two guys, you know, obviously they were not even yet old enough to understand Little Orphan Annie. So I'm sitting there in the middle, and the two of us, you know, the three of us were all sitting there. And by George, they're going to carry right on with this farce. They're going to go, you know. And you know that terrible feeling you get when you get in an airplane? A big airplane, like a 707, and it's going, that feeling of total helplessness. I have no charge. I'm out of control. I have nothing. I have nothing to do with this. And you get a vague feeling inside, well, they can't blame this on me. You know, when the thing is going to crash in the bay or something, you feel, well, not my fault. I'm just sitting here. I paid my fare. I'm here. I got my belt buckled, you know, somehow. If you buckle your belt, you're helping the plane go, you know, right? So you buckle everything and you sit there and hold on. And you feel great. Well, how do you think I felt? See, I'm sitting there, all the radar. So I started to busy myself with the equipment. You know, I'm turning it all on very efficiently, and the scope is going on. I'm testing this stuff, and I'm getting the keying frequency all set, and everything's going all the while. And this plane is starting to move. It's bumping along. Now, one thing I must tell you, the most scary part of it all, in this particular airplane, the radar man was in what they call a hooded compartment, which means you couldn't see out. It was just covered over. It was like night in there, you see, so you could see the scope. Night. And it had two little tiny slots about a quarter of an inch wide on each side. Little tiny slots. You pull back a little thing. And you could see a little slit out there. You can't see anything, but just like a little slit. Everything else is dark. So I'm in there. I got my lights on. I'm trying to figure this stuff out. Control bar. Control tower. Navigator. I'm being very official. You see, going by the book, I figured if I stuck with the book, at least there would be something to rely on. I've got the book, you know. So I'm going through my checkout list of all the stuff and all the why. You know, I'm trying to ignore the airplane. See, and it's going, it's pumping over the field. And it isn't like, believe me, those military fields were not like Idlewild. I can tell you this, they had potholes. There were wrecked fuselages of airplanes all over the place. And once in a while you'd hear, you'd see the ambulance going past. Very, very different. So it's it was raw aviation. And the airplane is very bumpy, and it's hotter than the fires of hell in there, you know. And I'm sweating and everything else. And by now, of course, I realize that I'm not only sweating from the heat, I'm sweating from something else. We get down to the end of the field, and I'm monitoring, you see, I'm monitoring just the intercom between the pilot and the control panel down there. What is the control? The tower, see? I'm sitting there, and the tower's talking to him, and I'm sitting, and it's, 820, number 2, 670, set clear for clearance, right? You hear this? Clear. And we sit for a second, and then he guns his motor. It goes. He's trying the oil pressure. At least he did that. And with that, he releases the brakes. The giant wearing blimp. Oh, down goes one wing, up goes the fanny, up we go, and these guys are having a ball. You know, they're like two little kids on a bicycle riding backwards. You know, that kind of thing. They're yelling and hollering at each other. Hey, watch it. Hey, watch this now, Fred. And I'd wait for a second to see what this is going to be. The plane is vibrating. I hear squeaks as he's running into the control. Oh, my God. Oh, and I'm trying. These guys totally forgot what we were up there for. We're trying to make this radar stuff go, you know. And he's just having a ball, you know. Well, you want to hear what finally happened? I finally break in. I say, can we go over the prescribed course? I'm looking for target 2. I want to go target 2, 17 degrees, 5,000 feet, fellas, please. The guy said, oh, yeah, okay. And we're flying now at 5,000 feet, and I'm trying to make sense of this radar equipment. It's going, and I'm watching the PPI, and everything's moving back and forth. Everything's fine. Okay. And now we're going, oh, we just passed target one. We're now on way to target two, a big triangular course. You know, we're working on the Stickman. I'm very official now at this point. I'm ignoring little Jimmy in the front and little Bobby in the back. I'm ignoring both of them, and I'm pretending that Chester Morris is in the front and William Holden is in the back. And the only kid on the airplane is me, old skinny Shep. See, I'm in the middle. So I'm working the equipment. And at that point, you see, I figured that if I began to call them sir, they might mature. You see, and so I say, sir, would you mind, sir, can we go into element two now, sir? Sir? And I was hoping somehow that Spencer Tracy's voice would come back. Instead, okay! Okay, already back there, Fred! Hang on, boy, here we go! Oh, we go into phase two! Oh, boy, I figure we're gonna leave our runners back then. Down we go. Well, this continues for about, I'd say, roughly 45 minutes until I had completed my poor little sad mission back there. I have my little charts, you know, and stuff about voltages and things, you know, and signal level and all that. And I got myself, and I'm very nervous. I says, well, that's it, sir. That's it, sir. It's okay back here, sir. That's it. See, all through? And I see, yeah, yes, sir, all through. Yes, sir, we can go back to the field now. Hey, Freddy, let's go! Oh, these guys, now they're on their own, see? They've forgotten this guy in the middle, see? Well, let me tell you, all of a sudden the bottom dropped out of this airplane. We're whistling along at about 390 miles an hour. This is a combat airplane, you know. It's not kid stuff. We are going along, no mufflers. They got nothing in this thing, and there's no skin on it. No insulation. Everything comes through. Yelling, you can hear the wings groaning. You can hear the wheels falling off. This guy goes down, and he lays that son of a gun down, and I didn't know where we were. He says, it's black where I am. I can't see. Have you ever been in a closet that was going mad? I mean, it was just, you couldn't see anything. See, I'm really scared now. So I don't know what to do, and I can't, my scope is not working. You see, it only works at a certain altitude, and I knew we weren't at that. Nothing. I'm getting nothing but blackness and a lot of fuzz and a lot of grass, and I'm getting nothing. I pull back this thing, and what do you think I see? I pull back my little slot. We are going so low, and the sound changed, you see. The sound was different now. It was coming up from all directions. I could hear a lot of sounds. I pull back my slot, and I see trees going past. Trees going past! Like mad! I could see trees. It was a blur. And I'm sitting there holding on. Oh, my. Oh, you know. It's going past. And these two guys are whoopee woo! Wow, watch. Hey, watch this, Freddy. Wow! Well, I look out of my little slot. We have just flown between what looks like the masts of a very small boat with very short masts. And but guys are yelling, you know. You could see guys throwing beer cans up. Get away. Whoa, we fly. Well, I look down, and we are flying about 3 inches over Lake Okeechobee. Well, do you know anything about Lake Okeechobee in Florida? See, well, it has a lot of little islands and a little bays, and these guys are playing hopscotch or something around the islands and around the bays. We're going around a big island. Watch this, Fred. Watch this. There's two fishermen down there with fly cast, you know, reels. Watch this now. He pulls the reel off one guy. He's got the line on the other guy. Well, we're really having fun, aren't we? Well, we're really having fun. And Freddie and Bobby and Charlie, they're yelling back and forth at each other, little squeaky high voices, you know. Whoa, I had the feeling like I'm on the bobs, you know, or on the roller coasters over here, and it's kids in charge. Well, I see coming ahead, I look around, I'm looking through my slot, you see, and I see we're getting to the end of the lake or whatever. Then the boy, have you ever flown over water about 400 miles an hour, about 6 inches off the... It goes, well, I'm looking out, you know, we're coming right at the trees, and at the last instant, he does something, I don't know, he puts the brakes on, throws in the thing, whoa, the airplane is skidding in the air, and finally, boom, it leaps over the trees, whoa, and Freddie says, that was great, Charlie, Bobby, that was wonderful. Well, we whistle over through the trees, and up into the, straight up we're going now, you see, we're trailing smoke, and leaves, and old moss, and fishing reels, and junk, you know, and a lot of stuff that I was letting go, too, at that point.
and it's all flying out behind us. You know, oh my God, no, no, oh no, no, oh no. We get up there, and the guy says, "Hey, hey, Mac." I'm Mac. Say, "Hey, Mac, you got your belt fastened?" My belt. Let me tell you, I had 9 straps. I hooked every strap I could find. I had wires around my feet. You know, I'm tying everything down. I got my earphone plugs around my neck. And I says, yeah, what's coming now? And with that, he flips it up on the back. He says, "Hey, Freddy, you always told me these wouldn't do this." He says, "I told you with the wind we'd have anchored the club." They're doing 14 consecutive barrel rolls with a half immelman in it. And this plane ain't built for that. And I can just feel it creaking. The wings are going. And finally we get it straightened out. And Bobby says, "Okay, we're running low on fuel. Hey, we're running low on gas." He says, "Oh, shut up. I'm throwing the reserve." Throwing the reserve. Well, this madness, this hell continued for it seemed like a good 7 weeks. I lost 24 pounds at that point, and I only weighed 37 in those days. Well, I'll tell you, we make a big final swoop over the lake. There were a lot of chicks down there. That's the whole point. Make a final swoop over the lake. He was trying to get a particular beach ball that he saw down there. We made a couple of final passes over the lake, and these guys headed over the swamps and back for Drew Field. And I am sitting in this airplane, hanging on to the thing. You know, there's a panel in front of me. I'm hanging on to it, and I try to turn my equipment on and everything. The wires are all hanging down, you know, sort of crazy and everything. I'm trying to hook it all up, and my papers are all over the floor and flying up in the ceiling and everything. I'm pulling them all down. And suddenly Freddie says, "Hey, how'd you like it? How'd you like it, Mac? A lot of fun, ain't it?" I says, "Yeah, it sure is. That's very good." He says, "How would you like to be our crew? We're looking for a guy to be crew with us." I said, "Well, I don't know how to handle this first lieutenant, you know. You don't tell him, go blow it out, Mac, you know. You don't say that." I said, "Well, and all of a sudden the captain in front says, "Hey, Freddie, that's a good idea. Hey, Mac, how would you like to be crew? You ready to ride this thing?" You know, and I could see myself spending the next 500 years of the war with these, you know, this 11-year-old kid and this 12-year-old guy. Oh, boy. So I'm hanging on. I said, wait a minute. I'm having trouble with the tier here. Tier problem. We'll talk about it when we get down." I'm hanging on to my knobs. Well, we come over Drew Field at about 2,000 feet, and they're flying absolutely straight now. They're back home, you see, with the colonel. Daddy is down there, and Mama's there. And they're flying this airplane just as nice and solid as a KLM pilot, you know. Nothing's happening, see. And we come flying over the field about 200 miles an hour. And I hear the tower down there.
Wind to southwest at 12 miles an hour. Check over.
And we come down, and you never saw anything like it. There's the runway down there, and I feel like I'm on a DC-6, you know, going to Chicago. These guys come in, and they touch that ground. They don't even make a bump, you know. We roll to the end of the runway. You know, they put the brakes on nice and easy, and we're taxiing back, and I'm sitting in this thing. Oh, I'm sitting in this thing, and I can feel my stomach. Oh, boy. And we go. And we sit there in dead silence in front of the hangar. And I can hear the mechanics climbing up the outside of the plane. You're clunk, clunk, hang on, whatever. They're opening the hatches. And these two guys get out, and I'm sitting in there, and have you ever had almost a partial paralysis of your limbs? You know? I am so scared, so relieved, so fantastically relieved that I can't even move. I'm just sort of sitting in there. I'm so glad to be down, you know. I'm just so glad I'm sitting there. And one of them said, come on, let's go. Let's go back. We're going to the PX. Come on. Come on. Hey, Freddie, come on. Let's go. I climb out of that thing, and my wires are falling off, and my papers are coming out of my pockets, you know, and my and sweat. I'll tell you, my suit was just filled. It just, I opened the zipper, and it went, you know, all over the ground. It's squirting. And my shoes, I have these big shoes on. They give me, they go, I'm squirting as I walk, you know, squirting along there. And I feel like my eyes are sunken in my sockets, you know. And it is not at all like William Holden is, you know. And here's these two little skinny guys. One guy's on my left and the other guy's on my right. And Freddie is on my left, and he's the first lieutenant, see. He weighs about 87 pounds, and he's got pimples. And now they were coming to a head because we'd been up in the air, you know, a lot. And the other guy, Bobby or Chucky or Charlie or whatever his name is, he's 11 and a half, and he's over, or 12 maybe, and he's over on my right, see, and he hits me in the arm and says, come on, boy, let's go out of the club. What do you say? Come on. Hey, watch this. And with that, they're throwing a ball back and forth. One of them's got a ball. Hey, come on, watch your long pass. Oh, William Holden, please come back, you know. Oh, Errol Flynn, you know. Come on, let's go. Well, we get back over to the PX. And we go in, and I'm sitting there, you know, and I go up to the counter. I say, give me a beer. Oh, give me a beer. Quick, give me a beer. And this guy says, hey, you got any Milky Ways? And the other one says, how about a powerhouse? How about a malt? Well, I'm sitting there, and now I'm feeling old. I'm feeling old and grizzled and decrepit and sinful. I'm drinking my 3.2 Army beer. And this other guy's chewing on his Milky Way. And I say, hey, come on. I'll tell you what. How would you like to fly out? Let's go fly out over the islands tonight. Come on, you want to go out? We go out. I got some time coming. They're going to fly over the islands at night. Oh, boy. How about, come on. Come on, let's go. How about being a crew? Well, I had to excuse myself as best I could. Being a corporal, I was at a certain disadvantage. But I handled it well. I said, I'm sick. I got up. I said, I'm not feeling good. I got up and I walked out. I go all the way down to the orderly room where they had this big BOQ orderly room and a whole big complex down there. And I says, I want to call Murphy, Camp Murphy, please. Murphy. And I dial Camp Murphy, and I finally get my company, and I get my captain on the phone. I says, Captain, can you send a jeep down right very fast? Is there anybody down here, Drew? I want to get back. He says, what's the matter? Why don't you stay down overnight? I says, no, I want to get back. 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 He says, what do you mean, Shepard? What's the matter with you? You want to get back to this hellhole, this pest hole, this mosquito bin? You want to get back here while Drew is in the Air Corps? What are you talking about? He says, I want to get back. Come on, let me get back. Well, 5 minutes later, I'm out hitchhiking on the road, you know. I'm hitchhiking my way, and I'm dead on a troop carrier. I take little rides to Deland, to Orlando. 7.5 hours later, I'm back in Company K, and I'm hanging onto my bunk. I don't know what happened to those two guys. They might have won the war, for all I know. But I'm hanging on my bunk, and I can see the skinny kid. I can see the other one with the pimples. I can see them flying the 707 now, you know, for some big airlines. I can see them, you know, and it says Captain Don Winslow, over 4 million miles, and at least 2 million of them were flying me around.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.
Altogether Lost, a new episode of Gene Shepherd, August 12th, 1963. To wrap us up here in the dustbin of history. We'll be back next week, another Hall of Fantasy. And, I don't know, we have another horror series to plug in. I got a week to think about it. Actually, less than a week, given the time I'm recording this. But we will be here midnight next Wednesday into Thursday on WBAI New York. A reminder again, Sunday night on the Golden Age of Radio. a thoroughly cleaned up and restored version of the first episode of Quiet Please. Gone is the snap, crackle, and pop of those noisy, awful discs that we're so accustomed to, restored with artificial intelligence. And we'll have Corey Harker, the man who devised the system, on to talk about it, how we did it. And so that's Sunday night, 8 to 10, Golden Age Radio. Read more about it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Max Golden Age. I'm Max Mead. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week and Sunday at 8 here on WBAI New York. If you enjoyed tonight's program and want to repay some of the hard work that went into putting it on and the lost sleep getting it together, why not go to WBAI.org and become a BAI buddy for the Dustbin of History, or make a one-time donation in the name of this program. Go to WBAI.org. Look for all the links on ways to give. WBAI always desperate for your money. If you had any idea the angst and sorus I had this evening, the very machine I'm putting this show together on crashed while I was in the middle of working on two different projects, and I had to redo it all over again. You know, help us buy some new equipment. Make a pledge. Support WBAI. It's listener-sponsored. There's no government money, not for us or anyone else anymore. We rely on the kindness of strangers and listeners like you. WBAI.org. Make a pledge. Thanks for listening. See you next week. So long, gang.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal. I'm going to go clean the bathroom.